Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 366, yes, it is year two of the Retina Podcast after 365 episodes, we bring you the preview of the November-December 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com and in print. It's available for free. And in this episode, I discuss with Akshay Thomas and Priya Vakharia the retina clinic of the future. What are the breakthroughs that are being looked at that may change the way we take care of patients? Things we've discussed before, but new things, including artificial intelligence, automated screening, smartphone applications for home screening, and of course, the ever-present discussion of virtual reality and its applications to medicine. We also talk a little bit about some controversies in the care of macular degeneration, and we end with the discussion of subretinal fluid and atrophy in AMD. Remember, you can find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description. You can also find a link in the episode description to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the preview of the 2022 edition, November-December 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. As always, remember, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com. We have four articles from this most recent issue to preview, and joining me for this, I have two of my colleagues from around the country. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Akshay Thomas from Nashville, Tennessee. Akshay, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Akshay.
And Dr. Priya Vakharia, who is joining us from Tampa, Florida. Priya, welcome.
Thanks for having me again, Jay.
Akshay, a side note before we get started. Two side notes. One is serious.
All right.
We'll do the not serious one first to not reduce the gravity of the second one. I did get a compliment I needed to pass on to you about our serial episode. I had two different medical students approach me who wanted to talk more about cereal, and they were not being ironic. I think they actually really wanted to talk about cereal. They looked forward to more discussion of breakfast cereal. I don't think there was any trace of irony or sarcasm there, so we'll file that away. Second note, not related to either of you, but this past weekend, Mike Tracy from Beaumont ARC passed away. We're recording this on October 23rd, 2022. I didn't know Dr. Tracy personally. I interviewed with him for fellowship years ago, but I have many friends and close colleagues who trained and knew him. And for all accounts, he was a great guy and a great mentor and someone who really revolutionized the field, but was also really revered by a lot. He's one of those people you never heard anything bad about, only good things. So, prayers to his family, rest in peace, Mike Tracy, and to all the people who knew him. I know they're thinking about him this weekend. Let's jump right into these articles. None of them are related to pediatric ophthalmology in Dr. Tracy's memory, but we have everything sort of about the future. This is kind of the end of the year issue for retinal physician. So I'm going to start with this article that Karen Y and Hassan Rahimi from Stanford wrote called The Retina Clinic of Tomorrow. And this is an article, again, we're not going to go through every detail of this. You can read it on your own if you'd like, but this is an article that just sorts about what are the sort of things that we will see in the future. These are things we've talked about on the podcast before. Telemedicine and hybrid encounters, home monitoring. Can you use your smartphone to do home monitoring, right? Why do you need a separate device? Can you use your smartphone to do OCT or some sort of fundus photography or other sort of Amsler type tests that you could do on your own to pick up wet AMD recurrences? They do talk a little bit about nodal vision and portable home OCTs, and they end by talking about potential application of VR, including this virtual reality device called All Eyes, which is for vision care that you can use as a VR headset in that way. I'll start with you. When you hear about all these things, I think all of them are discussed quite frequently. What do you think is going to be the most impactful? Like, what if someone's going to pick up their, 15-inch iPhone in, 2032 that they can barely lift with their atrophied hand that has never done any sort of manual labor? What are they going to do? What are they going to listen to in this episode and be like, oh, Akshay Thomas was right. X is the thing we are really using today that he was right on the money about.
Well, I feel like we've been having discussions about this. It's hard to believe that like no-tell type stuff has been around since 2010. And I feel like I still haven't used it a ton for my own patients.
So it's not no-tell. That's what we'll start there.
Well, I mean, I think in some ways it's already here, which is non-midriatic ultra wide field imaging. I mean, if we just look at the nature of referrals that we get right now in retina clinics, you'd argue that we're seeing a lot of things perhaps earlier. Maybe we're seeing a lot of, you know, optosomas or a lot of eyelash artifact related pathology, but I feel like we're catching things earlier. I think if the bigger question is, where are these devices and where is the screen placed? Are you having things that are placed in the home of patients or in our first line of care eye physicians, which are our optometry colleagues? And I think in some ways, I just think having wide field imaging widely accessible, not just for our optometrists, but even sometimes in our, we've talked about having this like in our diabetes clinics, right? Like when people go in to see their internist, you know, they get their fundus photo right there. And I think some of these integrated health clinics is probably what I see as a realistic near future type of thing that I'd actually believe in.
That's a great point. You know, it's funny you reference incidentaloma. It works comes right off the tongue for radiology, right? Incidental findings on imaging. We don't really have that term in retina, but maybe it'll be something like chorio-randomopathy or something like that, where it's something that doesn't really mean anything. You know, Priya, do you agree? I mean, do you think that's the big thing that will change what we do? Or I guess in terms of the biggest impact in terms of affecting the most number of patients and physicians?
You know, I think that all of these home screening devices are really going to change the field. You know, if you look at general medicine and you look at other fields, I saw this commercial the other day for an EKG that you could link to your smartphone. And there's some, like, you plug it into your smartphone and you put your fingers on it and it'll give you a real-time EKG. I think people in general want things literally at their fingertips, no pun intended. You know, they want to be able to do an OCT in their own house. They want to be able to access their physician from their own home. And so I think that we're going to have a little bit of a transition towards more home-based imaging as time goes on. I think this will be towards the end of my career, but that's kind of what I envision will end up happening.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I wonder where our AI is going to factor into that, right? Both of your ideas, both home screening, both non-midriatic fundus photography, I feel like we're going to be able to get at least some sort of automated interpretation. I mean, we've had automated EKG interpretation. It may not be accurate, but that's been there for decades now. You would think that a fundus photo, you would get some sort of thing that comes with it. I joke with my students, but I do think that you're probably going to see this at Walgreens, CVS, or just places you walk into where they take your blood pressure, take a fundus photo of both your eyes, and it's part of your health screening. Especially, you know, the interesting thing is, especially as you see more data come out from Duke and other places talking about the number of different things you can sort of figure out about somebody based on their photo, right? Or OCT, right? You can, you know, we know Alzheimer's patients have an OCTA pattern. OCTA is a long acquisition pattern. But if you start saying, okay, if you can over time get that same information with a shorter acquisition time, I mean, you could get a whole bunch of information. And it's probably one of the few places in the body that you can do it non-invasively. I mean, really the only parts of the body that are easily accessible are your skin, your mucosa, and then the retina is the only internal structure just because of the way optically it has to work. Everything else requires some sort of imaging that has a degree of penetration, whether it's ultrasound, CT, X-ray, or MRI, right? So I do think that there's potential probably beyond the ophthalmology space for screening. You know, the other thing they talked about, the VR thing is interesting. I'm a big VR pessimist, and it's not just because I get nauseous on VR rides my whole life. I think that there's a time and a place and a role for it. And I think that it definitely could democratize a lot of things educationally or in terms of access to opportunities or experiences. I'm a little more skeptical that it's going to really change patient care. I'd love to be proven wrong, but who knows? Maybe that will be something that will come up in the future. You know, the other thing I would say is, as we move into the next article, Priya, you wrote this article on AI for screening of diabetic retinopathy. It's not often we get an esteemed author of an article of retinal vision on the podcast at the same time. But tell us a little bit. I'm not going to run the article, but tell us a little bit what you think is going to happen. You showed some eye outputs for AI and DR. Like, this is pretty nice in terms of what we see here.
Yeah, thanks for the compliment, Jay. That was a huge ego boost. But this is an article just on artificial intelligence for screening of diabetic retinopathy. And there's two companies that have platforms currently. There's iNook, And then there's digital diagnostics, and they both have pretty comparable artificial intelligence machines that are right now approved only for diabetic retinopathy detection. And basically what this article summarizes is how the devices screen for diabetic retinopathy and the reports that are put out, and kind of how it could integrate into clinic. Now, you know, none of these devices are perfect. They still need to be validated by a physician if there's diabetic retinopathy on there. But the goal of this is that, you know, using these devices, you can get patients into clinic who maybe otherwise wouldn't come. So these devices can be portable. These devices can be placed in a primary care office. They can be placed in an endocrinology office. And unlike fundus photos, this gives a diagnosis in real time. So, you know, one could argue, what's the difference? You know, we do fundus photography and we have remote screens, but this gives the patient the diagnosis in real time, and then they can be plugged into clinic at the moment that they get the screen. And so I think that's the biggest benefit of these devices. And, you know, time will tell how much of an uptake there is in the general community, but the goal of this is to get patients into clinic who otherwise wouldn't come in.
Akshay, we both had the opportunity to read Priya with a really great article summarizing this. And I just referenced, I think that is going to be a big thing for screening. I mean, that diabetes is unfortunately not declining, but anything's accelerating. And the more patients who are diabetic, the more patients have diabetic retinopathy. And many of them don't live with access to easy visits to a retina specialist or optometrist, ophthalmologist who's going to take a look. So, I mean, I think this is huge implications, applications. I'm a little surprised, and Priya, you can comment after, actually, because I know you're involved in some projects in Tampa, but a little surprised at how slow the rollout's been. I mean, maybe I have my head in the sand a little bit, but I think that we were all talking, like you said, actually 3-4 years ago, IDX has been approved now for a bit, but the rollout hasn't really been fast. I haven't seen a lot of this implemented. Most people don't even know about it, I feel, or think about it. I mean, part of it has to be a little bit of expense, but I think part of it's probably market forces that you can't make a huge profit maybe off of it. I mean, what are your thoughts on why we haven't sort of seen that breakthrough? Very similar to Nodal, where Nodal has its own limitations, but we've heard about Nodal now for a long time too.
Right. I guess the question is, like you said, who's your market, right? Like this is not something that you're marketing to retina specialists, right? I mean, this would be something that you'd market to, you know, internists or in system, like Priya said, in places where they already have like set up systems where they have fundus photography, like in VAs where they have like standardized fundus photography and they have an ophthalmologist that reviews them and then sends them out if they find something. This seems like a natural fit into a place like that or into places where there's no access to care, right? So those are the places where this kind of thing would shine. But I think part of the reason I think we have our head in the sand is because we're not necessarily doing a lot of screening eye exams for retinopathy for the most part. So I think it'll just be about how much uptake there is in some of these avenues we already just discussed.
Yeah, you've been involved. I know you can't talk a lot about it, but in terms of rolling out some programs in Tampa with your colleague, David Eichenbaum, in terms of getting screening and reaching patients. I mean, just in terms of your experience, what sort of, I guess, challenges do you think have you seen in the real world in terms of implementing something like a screening program that's actually effective and actually is efficient?
Yeah, so we have been experimenting with AI screening devices in Tampa. There's a couple of problems. The first problem is, you know, making patients aware of the device and aware that it exists. But I find that actually the bigger problem is getting them to come into clinic after the positive screen. You know, the thought is with artificial intelligence, it gives them the diagnosis right then, and it really motivates the patient and says, oh, wow, I have diabetic retinopathy detected. Let me follow up. And it's really remarkable that even despite that, there is a huge element of noncompliance. And so that's been a little bit challenging, but I think for certain patients, it is really nice because, again, the device is portable, it's flexible, it's not just 8 to 5. They can kind of come whenever they want and get a test, which is nice.
So let's kind of go into co-management now. And we talked a little about screening. There's an article on retina specialist and optometrist co-management AMD patients by Jeffrey Gerson and Rishi Singh, an optometrist and retina specialist working together. And I think this is going to be something that is more interesting, especially as you move into an era of potential dry AMD treatment. It also is interesting, which they didn't talk a ton about in terms of scope, right? The scope of practice and what people are allowed to do, for example, injections in 5 or 10 or 15 years. And that's a whole different sort of conversation. But they do talk about some of the big topics, right? That we're trying to slow progression, lifestyle changes. And again, I think in 2022, right now we are end of October, for most patients with AMD, it can make a legit argument they don't necessarily have to see a retina specialist if they can get the appropriate screening imaging, which many optometrists can offer, ophthalmologists can offer. And as long as they're able to identify a change that would necessitate a referral to a retinal specialist actually for treatment. But I guess the real question comes now, we're going to see a burst of patients who maybe referred earlier because we have options. And we also have sort of that looming wait time, clinic backup, right, to get into your clinics to get these patients in. You know, what sort of things are you telling your optometry colleagues if you talk to them in the last couple of months about AMD, what they should keep, what they should send, and how is that going to change in the next year or two?
I think one thing we've definitely tried to discuss more is clinical trials that are available. I think there's certainly a number of patients that are being followed by our optometry colleagues with paracentral GA or that they just don't feel like they want to burden their retina colleagues with, thinking that there's really no options. But if they find a patient that's lost one eye to GA and paracentral GA in the fellow eye, and someone that's really motivated, I've had a couple that have reached out to me saying, hey, are there any clinical trials right now that this highly motivated patient may be right for them? So I think one thing we try to do is certainly educate them on ongoing trials. Doesn't mean that, you know, we necessarily put patients in trials if we don't think it's correct for them, but that's something we certainly kind of discuss. I think the other issue, and which the article also kind of goes into, is, you know, just the level of comfort of each individual optometrist in terms of, even if you have these imaging modalities available, what their level of comfort in terms of interpretation may vary widely. So I feel like there is some degree of co-management where I might say, you know, I'll check on you once a year and your optometrist might check on you once a year, so you're getting examined every 6 months or something like that. So there's definitely a lot of education that kind of goes into it, just letting them know what's available, but also not turning away patients for diagnoses that are perhaps nothing diagnoses.
Priya, what are your thoughts on what you should see and what should, I guess open door is always a good policy as a retina specialist. You can't see everyone. So how do you sort of guide your referring doctors?
Yeah, so I think Akshay summarized it really well. I think it, you know, for our referring doctors, it really depends on their comfort level. And I find it similar to diabetic retinopathy. If there's an optometrist who's very comfortable screening diabetic retinopathy, and, you know, when it starts getting in the severe NPDR, PDR section, that, you know, they're like, okay, this needs to have a higher level of care, I'm going to refer. But otherwise, if they feel comfortable, you know, they can manage the earlier stages. And I have the same kind of analogy to AMD for drusen, and maybe drusen and pigmentary changes, maybe, you know, the optometrist can follow. But then anything, you know, extrafoveal GA or anything that starts to become remotely vision threatening, I think that's the appropriate time to refer it. But it really depends on the optometrist. You know, there's going to be many of our colleagues who are very good at managing the early stages of disease, and many who just kind of want a curbside consult. You know, when I draw an analogy, when Vuity came out, I sent patients to other specialties all the time, because I actually had no idea which patients needed the drop and which didn't. So I really think that it all depends on comfort level. You know, in that regards, I'm not as comfortable with the refractive side, and so I usually send earlier. So it just kind of depends on comfort level and what the referring doctor wants.
Yeah, I like that. And that's kind of what I tell my colleagues here at Bascom too, is it's a give and take. And again, everyone's different in terms of what they're comfortable seeing and what technology they have available to them. So what you tell one optometrist in your community is going to be very different than you tell someone else who may be completely different age, completely different machine in their office, completely different comfort level, you said. And what they want to see too. It's not just what they can see, but what they want to see. So I think if you're a younger retina specialist, or someone in fellowship who's listening to this, you're confused when you move into your job, how do I decide? I think the easiest way is to talk to your senior colleagues who may know those people already and may know their preferences, or just talk to those people directly. I think it's one of the easiest sort of upfront questions to ask. They're going to ask you the same thing. I think they're going to ask you, okay, like what sort of things you want to see, what sort of things you like to see. I find that most people are worried about overburdening us, and that may lead to under referral sometimes because they're worried about maybe overcalling something. I think it's important, again, to lower the barriers and make sure people can be comfortable. Actually, he's nodding a lot because he takes care of uveitis patients. He's like, please, all those uveitis patients, please, no co-management. Send them to me right away. So let's keep going. The last article is unrelated to all of this. This is about a very hot topic. I'm going to preface this. By the time this comes out, I was asked to write a little comment on this article, which I still haven't done yet. It's not due until November 1st. So hopefully, if Michael Colicello, who wrote Circles, listening, I'm not delinquent. I'm just been backed up reading residency applications, but I will write it. But it's about the topic of macular atrophy due to anti-VEGF therapy. The classic question, does anti-VEGF make atrophy worse? And there is a discussion of different trials and what they've shown. I think this is important. I think if you are anybody who's going to be injecting, I think it's important to know both sides of the argument, understand the data that's out there, understand that there's conflicting data. And it's especially important, I think, as we enter this era where we're probably going to be treating CNVM and we're also going to be treating atrophy. And both pathways seem to go back and forth from some patients where you can treat atrophy with some of these drugs that are in trial and you get more CNVMs. And if you treat CNVMs too excessively, you get more atrophy maybe. And it's a little bit, again, it's very, very controversy. So I think that my question for you, Priya, do you ever modify your frequency of anti-VEGF because of a fear of atrophy? Or have you had examples where you've worried that a patient's atrophy is progressing and you'll back off of treatment a little bit? Like, how do you sort of make that decision of finding the sweet spot? Or does something not, doesn't, some people say it doesn't matter to me. They say, look, that's not going to make them go blind quickly. So that is a secondary concern because that may happen as a natural progression of the disease, regardless of what I do.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jay. You know, I haven't been looking at the atrophy as a way to guide my anti-VEGF. So to date, I've been looking at fluid as a way to guide anti-VEGF, with the exception of, you know, I do tolerate a little bit of subretinal fluid, as the fluid study showed, that can be, you know, it's thought that maybe that's a little bit protective to the development of atrophy. So, but in general, I don't usually use atrophy to guide my anti-VEGF because, like you said, some of that's out of our control. However, that being said, if I have a patient who has a lot of atrophy, maybe I'll be a little bit less aggressive as long as they don't have intraretinal fluid or otherwise they're doing well. Maybe I'll stretch them out a little bit more. But I think all of us are trying to get longer and longer injections. All of us are trying to get more durable agents. I think the bigger question is going to be, you know, with these super strong agents, are we going to find more atrophy with those as opposed to shorter acting ones? You know, I think the verdict is still out on that.
Akshay, what about you? Do you ever modify your individual patients where you'll say, look, I actually don't really want to treat you right now because I'm concerned?
No. I will say that, I will say
that one thing. Yeah.
No. I'd say the one thing though, is that if you look at all of our treatment patterns for wet AMD, there's some variability. Even if we're using a treat and extend approach, there's some variability probably between all of us in terms of what's the longest duration we're comfortable extending and do you ever stop treatment? And I'd say that some of this data, while conflicting, it's something that I use when I'm thinking about how aggressively to extend someone and whether to stop treatment. So in general, I know all the data points to us under treating patients on average compared to clinical trials. But for me, I tend to continue to extend and certainly stop treatment at some point if a patient, you know, is dry after a certain number of months. So I feel like some of this data, I feel like I'm doing some good perhaps if it pans out that more injection means more atrophy. But other than that, it doesn't really change how I treat patients.
You know, I will agree with you both. I asked the leading question and I think most people out there would say no, they don't stop or suspend treatment in a patient who is active from wet AMD or who's showing signs of activity. You generally don't extend. I mean, we can tolerate the small amounts of subretinal fluid, but we don't go crazy with stopping treatment extension. I will say one thing. I will say that patients that I may have before classified as a wet conversion, some of those patients I don't necessarily view as true wet conversions. And those patients are hard to describe in an audio format, but those are patients who have a PED that's starting to collapse. And if you do an OCTA, you'll oftentimes find a small CNVM kind of right under or adjacent that bed of atrophy. And there may be a trickle of fluid if you really stare at your OCT and zoom in. And I'm really cautious about starting treatment aggressively in those patients because I do think that in the past, maybe pre-OCTA and pre-understanding this, we might have classified some of those patients as a wet conversion and started treatment. I do think that some of those patients may have, I think it's a heterogeneous disease, and some of those patients may have a protective component to some CNVM that developed. They're not pathologic, they're actually protective. And that little bit of fluid may be from the CNVM. And it scares me when I do this, but there have been, I would say, count on one hand, three or four patients where I've simply watched them monthly and really kept an eye on them, given them an answer. They understand the risk. And I'll tell you, a very anecdotal, small sample size, none of those patients really converted. If anything, again, their dry has just been slowly progressing continuously and their atrophy is progressing. And I don't know if I had injected those patients, if their atrophy would have progressed faster. But I wonder if some of the confounding data we see in the trials is because of this mix of patients, because maybe for most patients, it doesn't matter, but there may be some patients who are more prone to developing a quote unquote protective mechanism with the CNVM. And maybe it does manifest a slight exudation, but it's usually not subfoveal. It's usually extrafoveal. And it's almost always right next to an area of atrophy. And I do wonder if that is where we get this whole argument back and forth about, well, this is protective, this is not protective. I think maybe both sides are right. And I know it's a boring answer, but both sides are right, because I'm sure there are situations where some people are progressing down the GA pathway and they may develop wet along the way, but it's not really the wet that's going to make them go blind. And there are others who you really need to be aggressive with the wet. And I think this is interesting because it's going to be interesting in the context of treatment for dry, because they have this CNVM rate, right? And I wonder if we start doing really detailed swept source OCTA in every single one of those patients, if a lot of those patients develop CNVM higher than the rates reported in the trials, but maybe the CNVM is part of that mechanism of blocking the complement system. And for some patients, that's their way they sort of protect their retinas with the CNVM. I don't know. I might be speaking completely out of my butt. I'm not an expert on OCTA. I'm not an expert on dry AMD or wet AMD for any matter. I'm just thinking, based on everything we've seen in the data that's been presented, that there's got to be some sort of connection there, but not in everyone. And that's why it's super, super confusing. But Priya, I don't know if you have any other thoughts on the subject.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's going to be really fascinating to see how we treat wet and dry AMD in 10 to 15 years. You know, think how much we've changed in the last 10 to 15 years. And so now with the advent of potential therapies for dry AMD, you're right. You know, we may find that there are certain classifications of CNV that are protective and some that are pathologic. And I have no idea what's going to happen, but I am sure that there's going to be a lot of research and a lot of data to come.
Actually, any final thoughts?
I'm waiting for us to get a dual anti-VEGF complement inhibitor. Oh. Right?
There's some evil scientist in the lab rubbing his hands. What island in the Caribbean he's going to buy for himself when he develops that? Yeah. I mean, if you put a positive and a negative into the same tube, do they cancel each other? Like, do they both work? Do they cancel each other out? I don't know.
Does it just become water?
You heard it first here, though. So just, you know, this becomes a thing in 30 years. I just want it to be noted that you heard.
Therefore, if we just inject water, it's the same as using a complement. I've just figured out the best way to pack. No, you know, it's funny. Akshay, I don't have any serial questions for you. I think we exhausted serial. I don't know why everyone was so excited. It was a little bit like a backhanded compliment. It was like, I loved your episode about cereal. It's like, really? Anyway, I appreciate you guys taking the time. Happy Diwali to both of you. I know you're both are really, really going all out celebrating it. So you're taking Diwali night to talk to me, and I hope you guys have a great night and see you soon.
Thanks, Jay. Have a good night.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks again to Drs. Thomas and Vicaria for joining me for this episode. Listeners, remember you can find all 366 of our episodes available on our website at retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. They're archived, easily searchable by category, and available for free forever for you to listen, to educate, and to learn about the world of vitreoretinal surgery. Remember that we're also on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And to reach out to us, you can reach out to us directly via the website by clicking on the contact us link on our website. You can find us in the Apple or Android podcast app on your smartphone, and you can email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to our whole production team. That includes Drs. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, Mike Vinicasa. Listener, thanks for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here each week, and the patients you take care of on a daily basis. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.